Case is Day versus Johnson, 9 SC 879. Are both parties ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just quick, couple of housekeeping matters. Justice Marquez will not participate in this case, and you're both reminded that 30 minutes aside, and you have to keep track of your time, and please state your name at the beginning of your argument. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michael Goodman, and I represent Richard and Loretta Day, the petitioners in this case. Also present is Joseph Bennett on behalf of the Colorado Trial Lawyers Association. The plan is for us to divide the time equally, with me to do 15 minutes in opening and Mr. Bennett to do a 15-minute rebuttal, and we will keep track of our time. I'm going to be asking this court to reverse and remand this case for a new trial. My focus today is going to be on the exercise of judgment portion of the instruction. That language, the exercise of judgment language in the instruction, is not an accurate statement of Colorado law, and I'll talk about the reasons for that, as well as why the instruction is misleading and confusing and how the instruction prejudiced the Days. I think it's important, as I begin, to go ahead and lay some context as to the instruction in a medical negligence case. Two instructions, 15:2 and 15:3, include the description of the standard of care. 15:2 is for a generalist, 15:3 is for a specialist. 15:3 defines the standard of care for a specialist as a physician who holds himself out as a specialist in a particular field of medicine is negligent if that physician doesn't act, which reasonably careful physicians acting as such specialists would not do, or fails to do an act which reasonably careful physicians acting as such specialists would do. And the jury is instructed that to determine whether the physician's conduct was negligent, it must compare that conduct with what physicians having and using the knowledge and skill of practicing in the same specialty at the same time would or would not have done under the same or similar circumstances. The way this is established at trial is the plaintiff presents evidence to establish the standard of care and the defendant's deviations from that standard of care, as well as causation. This case involves a thyroidectomy, and I think just a couple of quick facts are very important in the case. Dr. Johnson did not do an adequate assessment of this patient. He made a number of factual misstatements in his notes. One was that he identified that she had had known to have a multinodular goiter for at least a number of years, and that was incorrect. He stated that she had had biopsies, and she had not. He stated that the biopsies were benign, none were ever done. He stated that she was on adequate thyroid medication, but the lab reports showed that she was not. He also stated that she had some symptoms of fullness, but the contemporaneous medical records and her own testimony, Ms. Day's testimony, contradict that. Our standard of care expert identified a list of problems with the care that Dr. Johnson provided. The first one was the improper assessment for getting the wrong factual information. He was also critical of Dr. Johnson for failing to communicate with the endocrinologist, the gland specialist. It was below the standard of care for Dr. Johnson not to have done a needle aspiration biopsy to obtain cells and determine if it was a cancerous nodule on the thyroid gland. No surgery should have been done. During the surgery, the thyroid has two lobes. Dr. Johnson removed one lobe, sent it to pathology. The pathology came back without a major problem, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is treated through medications, and Dr. Johnson took out the second half of the thyroid. Dr. Johnson injured the recurrent laryngeal nerves, which are the nerves that innervate the vocal cords, and he did an injury bilaterally to the nerves. The surgery was performed on a Friday evening, and Dr. Johnson left, and the patient was transferred to the care of a surgeon who had substantially less experience and had neck surgery. And what's important about this criticism is that in this list of criticisms, this was the only criticism that the doctor characterized as being bad judgment. The doctor was not critical because it did not meet the surgeon who took over care did a reasonable job in the surgery that surgeon did.
So, Mr. Goodman, I just don't quite understand what you said.
I'm sorry.
Say that again, though.
Yes.
The business about the post-operative care?
Yes, the post-operative care.
Who criticized whom?
Our expert criticized Dr. Johnson as being bad judgment for turning the patient over to another surgeon who had less experience.
But that wasn't, that wasn't one of your theories of negligence, though, right?
Correct.
Two theories that you've already explained.
Because that surgeon did a reasonable job in the emergent surgery that Mrs. Day needed that evening. But what's important about that was the one item that was identified as being an issue of judgment by our expert. This list was identified in Mr. Yoon's brief on page 22, where he stated that the Day's expert specifically delineated the types of judgments that would fall below the standard of care. And I think that's a troubling statement because our expert really, for his true core criticism, did not identify any of those as being judgment. Where judgment came into the case was through the defendant's expert. And this was on May 28, 2008, from the transcript, page 187, where the defense expert said that it was judgment to remove the second half of the thyroid. And then it was asked a question, and there was testimony that judgment permeated all of Dr. Johnson's decisions in carrying the case. Let's talk about the judgment language in 15:4. 15:4 says that an exercise of judgment that results in...
I need to understand a little better. Who testified as to judgment permeated?
It was Dr. Book, who is
the defendant's expert,
and that was in a leading question by Ms. Glogowitz that he agreed that judgment permeated all the medical decisions in the case. The judgment language is an exercise of judgment that results in an unsuccessful outcome does not by itself mean that a physician is negligent. And I assert that the Court of Appeals got it wrong when they said all this means is that the outcome does not mean that the conduct was negligent. The language of the instruction, an exercise of judgment, is talking about conduct. And it's saying that that conduct by itself is not negligent. I would assert that the issue before this court is a matter of law as to the meaning of this instruction, if the review of the meaning of the instruction should be a de novo standard. I would assert this is an incorrect statement of law.
It's been given for years, hasn't it?
I'm sorry?
It's been given for years in a multitude of cases, has it not?
It has, Your Honor, but I don't know that anyone's challenged it before.
Well, medical malpractice is one of the most contested areas of litigation that I know about from 15 years up here, and this instruction has been given time after time, and apparently juries have been able to make sense of it. So what's your response to that?
I don't think that juries are able to make sense of it, and I think that it is a misleading instruction that is prejudicial and allows for unfair and prejudicial arguments.
Counselor, you just said, I'm sorry, if you weren't completed with that answer, you may continue.
I am completed.
Okay. I thought you were, but I wasn't sure. You just said that the instruction, an exercise of judgment, et cetera, mm-hmm. addresses conduct. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, and because it definitely is referring to an exercise of judgment, and it seems to me that that could be considered to be a judgment, a decision, and you're sort of taking it the next step further to talking about implementation of that in conduct.
Because what happens in those cases is that all of the physician's actions end up being described as exercises of judgment, and they thereby become protected and insulated from the standard of review analysis. And I can kind of give you an example through the proof that was submitted by the Colorado Medical Society in this case, where they attached the affidavits of three physicians. And those three physicians described how they view particular patients in specific particular circumstances and make decisions, and everything they do is permeated with exercises of judgment so that they should not be held culpable. And what they're doing is saying that because everything we're doing is so unique to the circumstances of the patient in front of us, that it's just an exercise of judgment, so it becomes a subjective standard of care. And that this instruction with that kind of argument results in the conduct not being reviewed.
Was the problem with the argument or with the instruction?
Both. The argument is an outgrowth of the instruction. The instruction doesn't give the jury any guidance as to what it's supposed to do with an exercise of judgment, how it's supposed to evaluate it. It tells the jury that it's not negligent, but it doesn't give a standard by which it's supposed to determine whether an exercise of judgment is reasonable.
The standard of care is set out in other instructions, right? This simply says is you've got to have facts showing negligence just because this particular operation was not successful. You know, you may do everything in accordance with standard of care. It may not be successful sometimes. That's just the way it is. So isn't this just saying the obvious, that the jury needs to find the facts of negligence and follow the instructions that have to do with that?
I don't think so, because I think the instruction is more insidious than that. I think the standard of care instruction tells the jury everything they need to know, because what the jury is supposed to be looking is at what the doctor did, the conduct that was done. What happens through this instruction is that a piece of that judgment is carved out, and the jury is told that judgment is supposed to be treated in a different way. And this instruction suggests that judgment somehow is different and is supposed to be viewed differently. But there's no guidance referring the jury back. Part of the problem is that there's no instructions to what judgment is. And I don't even know that that's possible, because as in this case, everything becomes judgment. Everything that the doctor ends up doing becomes judgment that is not, the jury is not referred to. In this case, as we discussed, our expert came out and described the deviations from the standard of care. The defense expert came out and said, that's all judgment. The argument on closing by Mr. Miller was, that's all judgment, and judgment is not negligence based on these instructions. And this instruction said, judgment's not negligence.
Well, counsel, can I stop you there? Doesn't it work the other way as well? I mean, you're suggesting that they will read exercise of judgment as conduct. Isn't that your argument? Yet then you say that actually conduct is distinct from judgment. I mean, we do have an instruction here that says you need to look at the conduct and whether that fell below the standard of care.
I think that this instruction confuses the issue and results in the misleading argument that everything the physician did was judgment. And that is what was argued in this case, and that's what their defense expert said. And this instruction...
But the instruction says conduct, the standard of care. That's the part I'm trying to understand, that part of your argument, because the instruction expressly says look at conduct.
That's correct. And that's what the jury should be looking at. And that's part of why this instruction is so unnecessary, because this instruction steers the jury away from looking at conduct. This instruction says there are these exercises of judgment, and those exercises of judgment are not negligent. And doesn't give the jury guidance back to look at what the physician did and determine whether what the physician did met that objectively reasonable standard. This instruction suggests a subjective standard based on the testimony of the experts in conjunction with the instruction that undermines the standard of care.
Isn't that exactly consistent with what the testimony was? If I understand, the opposing expert said that, for example, the decision whether to take out one or both parts of the lobe was an exercise of judgment, weighing the risks and the benefits of making such a decision. And that clearly is a judgment that the doctor is trained to make, distinct from an action that he then chose to make based upon his judgment.
I don't disagree that there were judgments inside the case, and that some of the actions, some of what the physician did were judgments, but some of it is conduct.
But assuming that there were judgments, and I guess we agree now that there were, then isn't this instruction, or at least the third sentence of that instruction, helpful to inform the jury that this is something they can also consider?
I don't think it is, Your Honor, because I don't think it instructs the jury what it's supposed to do with the judgment.
Well, it's supposed to,
in this case,
counsel, it's supposed to do with the judgment exactly what it does with anything else, which is take it into account. But isn't the language something like, but not give it credibility in and of itself? I think it says, does not by itself, an exercise of that kind of judgment does not by itself imply negligence. So, for example, if we were applying it to these facts, if a doctor was given a situation where he had to make a choice, take out both lobes or not, he exercised his judgment, we're only going to take out one, then if we read that with respect to the instruction, what the jury is being told is, the doctor exercising his judgment to take out only one lobe, for example, does not in and of itself mean that he was negligent. Rather, the rest of the instructions go on to suggest the jury has to determine whether that decision was negligent as against the standard of care.
I agree, but this instruction doesn't guide the jury back to say in evaluating judgment you have to go look at the standard of care.
Well, sure it does, because those are the elemental instructions as to what has to be proven. All it's saying is just if you're exercising judgment, that doesn't mean necessarily that there was a bad result, that your judgment was wrong. It could just mean that in this particular instance, that's the way the chips fell. Or it could mean that you were negligent. But you, the jury, have to figure that out.
And the instruction suggests that judgment isn't negligent, and the argument made
in and of itself
is that judgment was not negligent. And if all this is telling the jury is that judgment needs to be evaluated by the negligence standard, it's unnecessary. The negligence standard covers all of that. And this leads to arguments that are unreasonable and unfair.
Well, if that's your argument, how is it in contradistinction with the second sentence, which of that second paragraph, which I understand is unnecessarily in front of us, but there we're telling the jury that a bad outcome doesn't necessarily mean that there's negligence. In the third sentence, we're saying that an exercise of justice, of judgment, doesn't necessarily mean there's negligence. Aren't they parallel constructions?
I don't think they are. Well, I think that there's a difference in that the second sentence talks about one of the elements that the plaintiff must prove. The outcome doesn't prove that there's a problem with the conduct. The second, the exercise of judgment says the physician's exercise of this judgment and the bad outcome doesn't mean that the physician was negligent. So it's taking something that the jury should be looking at, which is whether that judgment was exercised reasonably, and saying that and the bad outcome doesn't indicate negligence. And I think that's confusing and misleading to a jury, and I think that that was exploited in this case and many other cases by the defense. I think, too, the judgments in themselves can be negligent. If you have a physician who is an obstetrician delivering a baby and all the objective evidence is that mom is in trouble and the baby's in trouble and the doctor's judgment is to do nothing, that in itself can be a negligent judgment.
And I suppose that you, in this particular case, had experts which said that it was a negligent judgment in contradistinction to the other experts.
My experts said it was negligent conduct.
Well, then at what point is it, are we just simply talking semantics? Because you have to choose to do something based upon your best judgment.
I agree. But if what this instruction does, it says don't look at the conduct, look at the decision-making into the conduct, and that's not negligent. And as a result, this insulates the conduct from the negligence analysis, and that's the problem with it.
Scriven, can I ask you a question? Let's assume that we were to agree that it's a confusing last sentence and adopt maybe not all, but some of your position. We all know that instructions are generally in the discretion of the court, what's given and how the wording is and so forth. And I don't quite understand, given the other correct instructions, and you've only cited a sentence in Mr. Miller's closing argument. So how does this become error in this case, justifying reversal?
There are two problems. One is we have our doctor talking about all of the deviations from the standard of care. That becomes characterized as judgment. Mr. Miller in closing actually mentioned it a couple of times. One is on May 29, 2008, line 106, where he says, exercise judgment or poor or complicated outcome is not negligence. And then he said, later, I would submit this case is truly about, did Dr. Johnson reasonably exercise his best judgment to try and help Loretta Day? And that's not negligent. And this jury, hearing that all this is judgment, and judgment is not negligence, and this instruction going ahead and basically ratifying that defense theory and saying that, yes, it's judgment and judgment's not negligence, leads to an unfair result. And I would submit that we've met the standard in Kleinecke versus Winnecke, that the court must order a new trial, and the result of the trial may have been different if the court had given the proper instruction. And I'd like to give the rest of the time for Mr.
For rebuttal. I was going to use my time.
No problem. Thank
you. Mr. Yoon. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is David Yoon. I represent the respondent, Dr. Bruce Johnson. The only issue before this court is whether the following instruction states the law correctly and should be given in medical malpractice cases. And that instruction says, an exercise of judgment that results in an unsuccessful outcome does not by itself mean that a physician was negligent. Contrary to Mr. Goodman's argument, this case did involve both conduct and judgment. As Justice Rice noted, the decision to remove the right lobe involved medical judgment, and there was expert testimony that they presented that the doctor did not exercise proper judgment in deciding to remove the right lobe. In addition to that, they also alleged that Dr. Johnson did not assess the patient correctly and did not properly recommend surgery. And that also involved judgment. And in Mr. Goodman's closing argument during trial, he in fact said this case is about judgment. He said, Dr. Johnson frankly didn't understand the patient. Garbage in, garbage out. Dr. Johnson can't exercise reasonable judgment, can't exercise good judgment if he's going to go ahead and get bad information and relying on information when he had the right information in his possession. So the case did involve allegations of negligent judgment, as well as there was another portion of the case which involved that the doctor cut the laryngeal nerve during the surgery. And that is why the trial court instructed the jury on the second sentence of 15:4 as well as 15:3, because there were two different theories that plaintiffs were pursuing.
Now help me with that again. The second sentence is the unsuccessful outcome sentence?
Yes.
Okay, and so you're saying, just walk me through that again. He exercised proper judgment. The outcome, his conduct was appropriate, but the outcome nonetheless was bad.
Yes.
And therefore it fits into an unsuccessful outcome does not by itself mean the physician was negligent.
That the surgery, the way the surgery was performed was negligent, and that second sentence addressed the surgical technique aspect of the case. And there were also allegations that the doctor, in deciding to remove the right lobe, exercised poor judgment. There were also allegations that the doctor should not have even done the surgery in the first place, and that was wrong choice of treatment.
The question I have is, given that you pointed out the judgment aspects, the mental part, which seems to me certainly true in many medical malpractice cases, because in order to do something, you have to make a mental decision about that, right?
Yes.
But what's missing from that last sentence is the connection to that a mistake does not result in liability, provided that the physician or the specialty physician is acting consistent with, ordinary and reasonable skill and care, right?
It does not say that, but as the court knows...
Well, it's in the other instruction. But isn't that a little misleading, not having that little tag?
No, because what we don't have is, unlike those case law that they're talking about, we don't have the word mistake. It's more neutral. It says, an exercise of judgment that results in an unsuccessful outcome does not by itself mean that a physician was negligent. And that principle, as the court knows, stems from a fundamental tenet of tort law that existed over a century, which is, as the Court of Appeals found, that an injury, the fact that a plaintiff suffered an injury without more, does not create a presumption of negligence.
And that's the outcome part, though, isn't it? Isn't that the outcome part as opposed to the judgment part?
Yes. The reason we have the judgment part in this case is because the case involved judgment. That's why that instruction tailors it to the circumstances of the case.
But wouldn't it be fairer, though? Why wouldn't it be, seem to me, it would be fairer to have that little tag on to the judgment part of that that's missing?
That it should refer to that...
Well, in other words, the judgment itself... It's certainly accurate, we say, provided that.
Provided that, that it conforms to 15:3,
yes.
Basically.
Right.
Well, as Your Honor just mentioned, when you're talking about the style and form of an instruction, that's reviewed under abuse of discretion, and trial court has a great deal of discretion over the form and style. And I would submit, given that the court, in under 4:1, the pattern instruction, the court actually instructed the jury that no single instruction states all of the law, all instructions must be
Let me ask you this. Did your opposing counsel ask for the tag on that Chief Justice Bender is mentioning?
Did not.
Well, isn't that important?
Yes, that's very important.
I mean, you know, these can be crafted, you know, given the evidence that's gone to the jury, right?
But wait, he did object, didn't he?
He tendered an instruction. Mr. Goodman tendered an instruction that's 15:3, containing the first two sentences, and deleted the third sentence. And I also want to object. I tell you that he never asked for a modification. And the only objection he ever made during the trial court is what we quoted in the brief, which is that this word judgment in the third sentence is a universal defense to everything. That was it. None of the arguments that they're actually making now about that is inconsistent with the standard of care instruction. It injects subjectivity. None of that was actually argued. Only defense was that the word judgment could potentially, as Your Honor pointed out, I think it's actually an objection to the argument, not the instruction itself. That he's really concerned about, that the defense counsel will use that phrase and misuse it. And if you look at the closing argument, he quotes Mr. Miller. Not once did he say, "Your Honor, objection, Your Honor, this is not an accurate statement of what you just read to the jury." That was never made. So he's now saying that Mr. Miller misused the phrase, but no such objection was made. And I would submit that the sentence by itself...
Mr. Yen, your point is well taken, that there's not an objection to closing argument. However... that aside for just a moment, would you agree that it is true that this instruction, which in your view is correct, is often misused by the defense counsel in the manner in which suggested here, that is, that everything is a judgment and thereby creating the impression or directly stating that these judgments are all immune?
I do disagree with that.
Okay.
I disagree that they fashion it as everything is judgment. One point they do make is what is a fundamental tenet of tort law, which is that a bad outcome alone is not evidence of negligence. That defense counsel do state. And it's because, as you can imagine, if a patient comes in for a routine surgery, goes to a hospital for routine surgery, and let's say the patient dies, what is a tendency of a normal person? That the doctor must have done something wrong. The doctor must have been negligent. And I believe 15:4 informs the jury and cautions them not to make that inference based on the outcome alone. And that's precisely why this instruction was given in this case.
Is everything a physician does an exercise of judgment?
Not always. but a lot of time it is. In this case, and I'll just talk about this case, the allegation was, in essence, that Dr. Johnson had a slip of the hand of the knife and cut the laryngeal nerve during the surgery. That it would be a straight conduct. But when you're talking about decisions to pursue a particular treatment choice, that, I think, case law says clearly a judgment decision.
And here we, how do we have both for sure?
We have both because they were saying that the doctor cut the laryngeal nerve. We have both because they were alleging that the right lobe should not have been removed. And we have both because that the doctor was negligent in recommending surgery as opposed to treating it medically. And that is a judgment call. And there was no dispute about that. And whether or not the particular language was used, I would submit not. I believe Mr. Goodman, in his closing, clearly made it clear that this is about judgment.
Can I ask one question about, we've said several times about the discretion of the court with regard to the wording of these instructions, but in light of our civil rule 51.1, how much discretion do you think the judge has with regard to giving this instruction and this instruction alone if the law fits?
The notes on you says that this instruction may be given along with 15:2 and 15:3, the standard of care instruction. And it has parenthetical for each sentence, which says, depending on the circumstance of the case, you can give the particular sentences. So I believe if you read the notes on use, it clearly gives the trial court discretion. And I have had trial judges, depending on the facts of a particular case, say, you know what, I think the third sentence is more important and more appropriate for this case because it's a judgment case and not the second sentence, or this is more of a second sentence case where they're talking about technique.
But do I hear you saying then that the judge only has discretion to do what the pattern instruction book allows him to do?
I do not believe your case law, Your Honor's law, says that they have to follow it. The rule does say that you should look to the pattern instructions to instruct the jury. I think rule 51.1. But I believe our case law says that the court has discretion to give the appropriate instruction.
Jim, you earlier were very specific, made a point out of the fact that this instruction does not include the word mistake. And I just wondered if you would talk to me a little bit about why that's significant.
Yes, it's very significant, as the Court of Appeals stated. And I will just quote first what the Court of Appeals said. Upon reviewing the instructions examined by other jurisdictions, we conclude that CJI CIV 15:4 should not be categorized as an error in judgment instruction, as plaintiffs contend. Unlike the instructions in the cases relied upon by plaintiffs, CJI CIV 15:4 does not expressly immunize a physician from liability for certain errors in judgment. And then it goes on. But what the court is doing is distinguishing those cases. This instruction does not insulate a doctor from exercising negligent medical judgment, mistaken judgment, error in judgment, or good faith judgment, unlike those cases. This instruction merely cautions the jury that an exercise of judgment that results in a bad outcome does not by itself mean that a physician was negligent. And that is far different from insulating a doctor from any exercise of judgment, as Mr. Goodman contends.
What about just confusing and duplicative and kind of defense-oriented?
Sure, Your Honor, and that goes back to what I was actually mentioning before. I also want to say that although this court said discourage repetition in instruction, it has never held that repetition alone in one particular instruction is an abuse of discretion. And I would submit in this case, it was not repetitive because there were two different theories. One, the cutting of the laryngeal nerve to address, the second sentence was necessary to address the negligent performance of the surgery. And then the third sentence was necessary to address the judgment aspect of plaintiff's theory. So I don't think it's repetitive, but I don't think, even if the court construed it as repetitive, that that merits a reversal of a judgment.
It would be better if the parallelism was actually very apparent. So, for example, if the instruction said a medical procedure that resulted in an unsuccessful outcome does not, for example, followed by the sentence that said an exercise of judgment that results in an unsuccessful outcome, it were precisely parallel, wouldn't it?
I
mean, that's in essence the distinction you're asking us to draw here.
Yes.
Yes,
I think it would.
It's not necessarily drawn, because the "an unsuccessful outcome does not" repeats itself in the third sentence. That part, "an unsuccessful outcome does not" by itself mean that a physician was negligent, is present in both sentences. The difference is the beginning of the third sentence, "an exercise of judgment that results in," right?
Yes.
All right. But and so I guess the question that others are asking is, well, that distinction, as we talk about it and think about the facts of this case, is pretty clear to us. You know, maybe it just wasn't to the jury, and so therefore maybe to the jury they couldn't really understand the difference between the second and the third sentence. And when the third sentence was read to them, I mean, at least it would be the plaintiff's perspective that they were then being told, well, there's got to be something more than just a bad outcome here. Maybe I do have to immunize our judgment, or else they wouldn't have given us this third instruction, this third sentence.
Well, I don't agree with the last portion that it immunizes all physicians, but certainly if you want to tailor it to a particular case, as Justice Hobbs mentioned, plaintiff could have said, "Your Honor, I think I'm fine with those two instructions, but I think it needs to be tailored better." But they did not do that. So that's one thing. But I don't think you can read "an exercise of judgment that results in an unsuccessful outcome does not by itself mean a physician was negligent" to say that it immunizes physician for negligent judgment, or it immunizes all exercise of judgment. If that were to happen, I think the proper construction would be "an exercise of judgment or a bad outcome does not mean negligence," or something like that.
Or an exercise of judgment or a procedure or a medical procedure that results in an unsuccessful outcome. I mean, it's hard to figure out what the words actually would be to set up judgment versus action.
If you believe that the instruction, you're trying to immunize the physician for exercise of judgment, you would say an exercise of judgment is not negligence. That's how you would frame it, but that's not what the sentence says. It's really focusing on poor outcome. And exercise of judgment is added to it to clarify the particular facts or particular type of professional liability case. And
I actually think it might be the other way around. That is, it's referring to an exercise of judgment of a particular kind. That is, the kind that results in an unsuccessful outcome. Is that not correct?
It's an exercise of judgment leading to an unsuccessful outcome. It's not negligence. Alone.
Right. But it's read within the first two sentences. First one saying that you don't promise an unsuccessful.
Yeah.
Okay. So those first two sentences.
Yes. Right.
Right.
So there's an implication of what Justice Martinez and Justice Rice are saying.
In other words, the first two sentences saying is, we're not guaranteeing that you're going to have a good result.
Yes.
And the next sentence basically says, and you know, an unsuccessful outcome doesn't mean that it was negligent.
Yes.
And the third sentence says, and this is a complicated one, an exercise of judgment that results in an unsuccessful outcome doesn't mean it's negligent. And so the problem is in the context of that first part, what is the real difference between the second and the third sentence without there being kind of a phrase or something that defines the conduct defined in the second sentence as opposed to the third sentence? Judgment versus action.
I think the way the case was presented, that and the way, and it's up to the lawyers when an instruction, I would say, is stated as neutral as possible, and then the attorneys provide the context to that. And if Mr. Miller said something that was inaccurate, it's Mr. Goodman who would say, that's not what the instruction says. In this case, this is how it's applied.
But you would agree that these instructions could be written a little bit better?
It could be fashioned better for a particular case, yes. It could be, but no such language was proposed.
Along those lines, and I do understand your point that there's no objection to argument. I understand your point that there isn't a proposal here from, made in the trial court for some difference or clarification in that of that instruction, other than eliminating that last sentence. But nonetheless, on the grounds, along the lines of how this could be better done, notwithstanding what I just referred to you about your argument, isn't what's missing there sort of? Well, if an exercise of judgment that results in an unsuccessful outcome by itself doesn't mean that a physician is negligent, then what does? What kind of exercise of judgment, or if not by itself, what else has to be? Does it have to be accompanied by to get to negligence? In other words, and I know that. When you read it together with the negligence instruction, then it kind of provides that, which is in a separate location. But isn't what is sort of incomplete about this is it doesn't give you the other hand. It gives you one hand and then doesn't say where to go to figure out when it might be.
Well, I think that's in this case, or in most cases, they're read together. They follow together. And the court always instructs the jury that you got to consider all of the instruction as a whole. And if you read it together, it's clear what the instructions say, I believe, Your Honor. And could it be done a little bit better and say, as referred to in 15:3, possibly. But I think in a lot of the cases...
Well, that might help lawyers, a cross-reference like that.
That may help. And I think Bryson was saying, it could help, but it helps. You can't really set up, here's how it should be instructed every single time, because every fact is different. And that's what I think... If the party is concerned that it's not completely tied, I'm within the trial court's discretion, they seem to go, I agree, that makes sense to add a, procedure. And I've seen a lot of judges do that.
Well,
and
what if it were only a judgment case? How would you feel about leaving out the second sentence?
If it was purely a judgment case, mm-hmm. I think that would be appropriate.
So
I've had a case where they only gave the third sentence.
Really?
Yeah.
What kind of
situation? Purely the arguments were made, and I agree there was also a need for the second sentence, but the judge, trial judge said, I think I have discretion over which sentences to give, and this case seems to be a purely judgment case, and I think the judgment sentence is the appropriate one. That could happen. It could happen the other way around, too. The second sentence is appropriate. And I think that's what the instruction allows. And because I only have 7 minutes, I just want to talk about harmless error doctrine. We're not saying this is error, but assuming for sake of argument that it was error to instruct the third sentence in 15:4, I would submit there's at least 3 reasons why it would be harmless. One, as they claim, they say that the second sentence and third sentence are repetitive, conveying the same message. We say it's a little bit different because we have a judgment case, but assuming that's true, I would submit to you, since they didn't object to the first 2 sentences, and Mr. Goodman actually tendered an instruction containing 2 sentences, giving the third sentence, adding a third 10 sentence when it conveys, as they claim, basically the same message, could not affected the verdict. And therefore it's harmless. 2, courts have said that in other jurisdictions that a mistake or error in judgment instruction is not reversible error as long as the other instructions properly instructed the jury on the law. And the standard of care instruction, 15:3, was given, and I would submit that when you consider those instructions, it was harmless error. And two, we are talking about one sentence in a, three, in a set of more than 30 instructions. And to argue that that one sentence affected the outcome of the verdict is just simply not credible. I would submit to you, if you look at all of the instructions and all of the evidence, that it was a harmless error to even give that third sentence, even if it was error, which we don't agree.
Tim, can you just tell me how long was the, how many days was the trial and how long were the closing
arguments? It was a 7-day trial. I think it was a total of 7 days. I remember the second week, so it was almost 2 weeks. And the jury was out.
I want to know how long the closing arguments were.
The closing arguments were, I read Mr. Miller's portion, and I don't think it was more than 15 or 20 pages. So whatever that takes, I would presume it was less than 30 minutes if it's 15, 20 pages. So I think that the evidence was overwhelming that Dr. Johnson was not negligent in performing surgery or recommending surgery, and that the intubation after the surgery, when Mrs. Day was thrashing around, was the cause of the vocal cord damage she sustained, and not the surgery itself. And I believe that the jury reached the correct decision, and to say that one sentence in 15:4 made a difference, I just don't think it's credible. Thank you, Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Joseph Bennett. I'm with the Federal Clinic of Colorado Springs, and I'm here on behalf of the Colorado Trial Lawyers Association. And I do appreciate you giving me the opportunity to participate in oral argument. The standard of care instruction, 15:3 in most cases, talks about acts and omissions. It doesn't say anything about judgment. 15:3 tells the jury that a physician is negligent if he doesn't act, that a reasonable physician would not do under the same or similar circumstances, or doesn't do an act that a reasonable physician would do under the same or similar circumstances. This court has held over and over and over and over again over the years that that's an objectively reasonable standard, and it must be established by expert testimony. 15:3 says nothing about judgment. Acts and omissions. Medical care is a series of acts and omissions and decisions and exercises of judgment.
Well, counsel, can I just follow up on that, that sentence? I'm wondering then, do you disagree that there may be cases where this is a judgment case? I mean, that's basically Mr. Yoon's argument. And there may be cases where this is a judgment case and this may be a case of a conduct case or some sort of, I guess his example was accidentally cutting when, I mean, it was an act as opposed to some sort of judgment, exercise of judgment. Or is that a false dichotomy, do you think? Or?
I think so.
Okay.
Judgment is an argument. Judgment is an excuse. The case is about what the doctor did or didn't do. It's not about what he was thinking when he did or didn't do something. Judgment is not a legal term in this context. Judgment is a medical term in this context. Judgment is what some expert witness says it is. If an expert witness
Can I just challenge that a bit? Because that just feels to me like a bit of an overstatement. Like, I get a doctor does something. But let's just take our example here of cutting one note or both, which I'm not even sure is right medically. But don't you have to isn't there a weighing that goes into it? The advantage of doing this would be X, but the disadvantage would be Y. And so I'm going to exercise my judgment when I decide what I'm going to do.
Sure.
Now, and that's exactly the conundrum we're finding ourselves in here, isn't it? So I don't want you to oversimplify your argument. So in light of that, tell me what you're thinking.
What I'm thinking, Judge, is that doctors make decisions in the medical care. And they make the decisions, they use their knowledge, their skill, their experience, lab tests, they gather up all the information and they make a diagnosis. A diagnosis is just a judgment
sure.
about what you think is wrong with the patient. So if a doctor diagnoses a particular illness, the question that the jury has to decide is whether he made a reasonable decision as to what was wrong with the patient, not did he go through the right, methodology of coming to that conclusion. If the conclusion was wrong, and of course, if the conclusion was right, we wouldn't be in court. If the conclusion is wrong, then the jury must determine whether that conclusion is wrong because the doctor acted reasonably or not. Couching it as an exercise of judgment simply confuses things because, and that's why the experts on the defense side usually bring these things up. And in this case, Dr. Book, the defense expert, gets up and says, well, judgment permeates everything. And I think jurors kind of like that kind of argument from an expert witness and from a defense lawyer, because I think people understand that juries, that doctors have a hard job. And so there's sort of a feeling among jurors that, maybe the doctors should be given the benefit of the doubt. That's what this instruction kind of suggests to them, that if it's an exercise of judgment, you got to kind of defer. And it doesn't say that, but it implies that, and that's certainly the way it's argued. Look at the way Mr. Miller argued in this case. He gets up, he points to instruction 15.4, and he says, that outcome is not negligent. An exercise of judgment that results in a bad outcome is not negligent. That's what he said in closing argument.
Well, he should have said in and of itself is not negligent, but there wasn't an objection to that fact.
There wasn't an objection, right. But I think by objecting to the instruction itself.
I understand, but it's the in and of itself, that nuance that we're really missing here. I mean, it wouldn't be any more proper, I think, for a defense lawyer to stand up and say, any judgment that the doctor makes is immunized, than it would be for you to say, on the other hand, well, we're not really concerned about what the doctor is thinking or his weighing or differential diagnosis process, but only what he ends up doing.
I'm not really critical of the argument. I'm critical of the instruction, because the jury can draw that conclusion from this instruction even if the defense doesn't make that argument, because the instruction is worded in a way that suggests it. And so it can be inferred.
So can I have just one more follow-up? So do you think that basically the word judgment should not be used, or what's the proper way to discuss judgment in front of the jury?
I think that judgment should be discussed in front of the jury by the experts and lawyers, and it should not be the subject of an instruction. And I don't think you can fix the problem by changing the wording to include, a reference back to the standard of care instruction, because if you look at the cases from the other jurisdictions that have struck down similar instructions, most of those cases do include that language. And even though they include that language, the courts have still struck them down as misleading, confusing, and inaccurate statements of law. This instruction is only superficially correct. I know that, this court granted cert on the question of whether this instruction accurately states the law. And the defense has argued, and the Court of Appeals found, that the instruction is accurate, but it is only superficially accurate. The Court of Appeals based its decision on Brown versus Hughes and actually quoted from Brown versus Hughes, but, you know, it was very selective quoting. And if they had actually quoted what this court said in Brown versus Hughes, this instruction is clearly not accurate. This court clearly said that an exercise of judgment is not negligent unless it violates the standard of care. This instruction omits that. And I don't think you can just automatically assume that the jury, by putting in the words by itself, that the jury knows, well, yeah, you have to go back to 15:3. Because look at what the next instruction, in this case, was the best judgment instruction. And that just confused, you know, now you've got one saying judgment and one saying best judgment. Does that mean that a doctor is not responsible for a deviation of the standard of care if he did his best? That's certainly not the law in Colorado. The last point I would like to make is that it has been asked, I think, by Justice Bender, why this instruction, assuming this instruction is wrong, why is it prejudicial? It's prejudicial because for the reasons that the defense lawyers made in their arguments to the court at the instructional conference. The defense lawyer said, this instruction is critical to our case. It is central to our case. It is our theory of the case. We intend to argue that this is a bad outcome case, and we need this instruction. And I'm telling you, this happens over and over and over again in medical malpractice cases. This instruction, it's subtle, but it is there, and juries will glom onto it because they are looking for reasons to not find the doctor. Nobody wants to think that doctors are negligent. Nobody does. This instruction misleads them, and it takes them away from the inquiry into the acts and omissions of the doctor and gets them inside the doctor's head. It's a watered-down version of 15:3 or waters down or dilutes 15:3.
See, that all assumes that the counsel isn't going to be right on top of his or her game and argue the breach of the standard of care. I just don't get that. I mean, you know, you're going to get up there and do your job and show that every act or every judgment in this respect, based on what our expert said and his knowledge of the standard of care, was breached. I mean, you know, this is a fair game, isn't it?
This instruction actually tilts the scales of justice.
Well, if you just pull it out and start to scrutinize it, but
I understand what you're saying, but I don't think juries are that. I mean, you know, we're here in a different kind of context. A jury is. It matters what a jury is going to infer from this instruction, and the problem with the instruction is it gives the jury an opportunity to infer something that they're not supposed to be focused on.
And yet we're supposed to defer to the fact that they're exercising their judgment based on the facts and doing their job, you know?
So I understand that. I understand that we all exercise judgment. Lawyers do it. Everybody does it. I get that. And I'm not saying that there's no place in medical malpractice cases for a discussion of judgment. I just think it should come from the witness stand and from the lawyers and not from the trial court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank both attorneys for their arguments. The case stands submitted, and the court is now in recess.